You're listening to KBOO Portland. The time is 8:59 a.m. Next up, we have Radio Zine.
The brave guy who comes on to kind of tilt for the...
Hello, KBOO members. Thank you for being a part of our amazing community. Please join us this year at Mike to the People, our annual election meeting. Do you want to help steer KBOO in a positive direction this fall?
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of That's No Lady, That's Darcel, produced by Triangle Productions. The play runs from September 19th through October 5th at Portland State University's Lincoln Performance Hall in Portland. Walter Cole owned the first Portland coffee bar, then bought an old beer and wine tavern. He began a drag act that, in 1974, became Darcel 15. This musical tells the life story of Walter, Darcel, and more. Again, that's Triangle Productions, That's No Lady, That's Darcel. From September 19th through October 5th, at Portland State University's Lincoln Performance Hall, located at 1620 Southwest Park Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Welcome to Sojourner Truth. Thank you for staying with us. This is your host, Margaret Prescott. Ahead of a crucial election, important for Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, the Israeli Prime Minister has yet again threatened to annex swaths of Palestinian territory on the West Bank, pretty much putting the death knell onto a two-state solution. Why is he making this move? What's going on? What are the implications for not only Palestinians, but for the entire region? Our guest is Curry Peterson-Smith, Michael Ratner Middle East Fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington, D.C. He researches U.S. empire, borders, and migration. Also, justice for port truck drivers. Why are truck drivers going on strike in Los Angeles and Salt Lake City, Utah? That is port truck drivers. We speak with trucker Flavio Acosta. And the Movement for Black Lives Electoral Justice Project, this for our Campaigners for Black Lives ongoing series. Our guest is Angela Waters Austin, co-founder of Black Lives Matter Lansing and Black Lives Matter Michigan, as well as the CEO of One Love Global. We live in a global world. We're all interrelated. So on Sojourner Truth, we work to bring directly to you news and views on local, national, and international policies and stories that affect us all. And we draw out how those of us most impacted, women, communities of color, and other communities are responding. We also discuss the interrelationship between art and politics. Now for our news headlines.
I'm Max Pringle with these headlines. A court in Scotland ruled today that British Prime Minister Boris Johnson's suspension of Parliament as the Brexit deadline looms was illegal. Judges at Scotland's highest civil court said the government's action was illegal because it had the purpose of stymieing Parliament. But the Court of Session judges said Britain's Supreme Court must make the final decision at a hearing next week. Brexit opponents in Parliament demanded that Johnson reconvene the Parliament so MPs can debate Johnson's Brexit plan. Tommy Shepherd is a Scottish National Party MP.
We ought to be in Westminster this morning representing our constituents, and we're not because Boris Johnson has chosen to shut Parliament down. That has now been ruled to be against the law, and Parliament should be immediately reconvened so that we can consider what Boris Johnson is doing to this country.
Johnson claims he shut down the legislature this week so that he can work on his domestic agenda at a new session of Parliament next month. But the 5-week suspension also gives him a respite from rebellious lawmakers as he plots his next move to break the political deadlock over Brexit and lead Britain out of the EU by October 31st. The Scottish judges referred the matter to the Supreme Court for resolution. A hearing there is due to begin Tuesday. Americans are commemorating 9/11 with mournful ceremonies, volunteering, appeals to never forget, and rising attention to the terror attacks' extended toll on responders. A crowd of victims' relatives gathered at Ground Zero in Lower Manhattan today. President Trump is scheduled to join an observance at the Pentagon. Vice President Pence is set to speak at the site near Shanksville, Pennsylvania, where a third airliner went down after passengers rebelled against the hijackers. 18 years on, the attack's aftermath is visible from airport security checkpoints to Afghanistan, where a post-9/11 invasion has become America's longest war. Conservative Republican Dan Bishop has won a special election for an open House seat in North Carolina. It's a seat Republicans have held for more than 50 years, and which President Trump won by 12 points. The election was a holdover from 2018, when the results were voided amid fraud allegations. But Bishop's narrow victory over centrist Democrat Dan McCready didn't erase questions about whether President Trump and his party's congressional candidates face troubling headwinds approaching 2020. Bishop told CNN Trump has a winning formula.
I would say that the Trump vision is a very attractive one, and it makes all the sense in the world to embrace it. How could you not like it? It's a stronger economy, a robust economy with lower taxes and more jobs and border security.
Bishop is a state senator best known for a North Carolina law dictating which bathrooms that transgender people can use. He tied himself tightly to Trump, who staged an Election Eve rally for him on Tuesday, and voting seemed no less than a referendum on the president. Trump quickly took credit for the triumph, proclaiming a big night for the Republican Party on Twitter. The California Senate has passed a bill that would give new wage and benefit protections to workers at so-called gig economy companies like Uber and Lyft. The bill now goes back to the state assembly for final approval over strident Republican opposition. Democratic Governor Gavin Newsom has said he supports it. KPFK's Rita Eed reports that before the vote, Los Angeles rideshare drivers urged the city council to support the state bill.
Members of the group said the bill would stop Uber and Lyft from misclassifying drivers who drive 30, 40, even 50 hours per week as independent contractors, effectively denying them basic wage protection and health care benefits. Linda Valdivia with Rideshare Drivers United.
We have all the responsibility to pay expenses, to buy our own medical insurance, to pay everything, all the expenses, car wash, oil change.
Industry experts say that the law could increase labor costs for Uber and Lyft by 20 to 30%. Some drivers fear that the higher cost would be passed on to the customers, who may abandon the platform for lower cost alternatives. For KPFK Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, I'm Rita Eed.
The state Senate moved on Tuesday to cap annual rent increases statewide for most tenants. The bill is an effort to deal with the state's housing affordability crisis. And as Christopher Martinez reports from Sacramento, the bill also includes a just cause eviction component.
AB 1482, the Tenant Protection Act of 2019, was authored by Assemblymember David Chu of San Francisco. He says lawmakers need to act to keep renters in their homes during the most intense housing crisis in California history. His measure would cap rents for 10 years while the state tries to speed up housing construction. It would also enact just cause eviction, requiring landlords to give a legally valid reason for evicting a tenant in order to prevent discriminatory or retaliatory evictions. Republicans and other opponents say the bill would create a disincentive for new construction. In the floor vote, AB 1482 passed on a straight party line vote. The measure now goes back to the Assembly for a final vote of concurrence on amendments. Reporting from the state capitol, I'm Christopher Martinez.
And I'm Max Pringle. You're listening to Sojourner Truth on Pacifica Radio.
This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. On Tuesday, September 10th, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu announced plans to grab Palestinian territories in the West Bank if he wins re-election next week. This move is predicted to end hope for a two-state solution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. During a press conference, the far-right leader Netanyahu told reporters that if he's reelected and able to form a coalition, he would apply what he called Israeli sovereignty over the Jordan Valley, which borders the nation of Jordan, and the northern Dead Sea. Around 65,000 Palestinians and 11,000 Israeli settlers live in the Jordan Valley and the northern Dead Sea area. These settlements are illegal. The main Palestinian city is Jericho, with about 28 villages and smaller Bedouin communities. Netanyahu's plan, of course, violates international law. To make things worse, he added that he expects Donald Trump to present his so-called peace plan for the Middle East later this month, and he implied that Donald Trump would approve of his announcement. Let us go to a clip now from Al Jazeera.
Bit of breaking news, and the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has said he intends to annex the Jordan Valley in the occupied West Bank if he is to stay in power after the coming election. We've got Harry Forson in West Jerusalem to talk us through this. Harry, well, please do that action. Explain exactly where are we talking about, the Jordan Valley?
Well, we're talking about the Jordan Valley being the area alongside the Jordanian border to the very east of the West Bank. It occupies about 30% of the occupied West Bank. Most of it is under Israeli military control already, as Area C, as it's designated, has some 65,000 Palestinians living there, and also there are about 37 illegal Israeli settlements in that area as well. What's interesting about this statement, though, is that it's not really as was sold just minutes before Netanyahu went to the podium to make it. Already there were indications that this was going to be a very political statement in the final week of the election campaign, as he's desperately trying to get more and more right-wing votes for his Likud ruling party. But there had been reports that, as well as that, that he would announce the annexation of the Jordan, of the Jordan Valley, and that he would announce some kind of American green light, some sort of approval from the Trump administration, even though for now it is delaying the release of the Trump plan. He didn't do that. Instead, he merely asked for a mandate from the Israeli people, said that he was the man that needed to be in charge of the Israeli government after the election, in advance of the Trump peace plan coming out, that Yair Lapid and Benny Gantz, the co-leaders of the main opposition party, they wouldn't be able to get it done. And then he started to detail some of the follow-on effects of such a plan. But it is just a plan. And he has made similar such promises in the past, before previous elections, indeed before the last election in April, that ended with coalition talks breaking down so dramatically and Netanyahu calling for another election. In a couple of interviews, he talked about extending Israeli sovereignty to Israeli settlements, illegal settlements in the occupied West Bank, even mentioned a couple by name. And one of the main Israeli political reporters in this country, Anshul Pfeffer, was tweeting just before this announcement, saying that you have to remember that in the coalition talks that happened after that election, he rode back or didn't give any ironclad commitments. So there is some skepticism about all this from the Israeli media. Indeed, when it was clear just how much of an electoral statement this was, when that became clear, a lot of the channels moved away from him in mid-speech and started in a fairly mocking tone talking about here's another supposedly dramatic statement from Benjamin Netanyahu. So we have to see it in that light.
Interesting stuff. Okay, thank you. Harry Fawcett in West Jerusalem with that update.
All righty. So the election referred to in that clip, the snap legislative elections that will determine whether Benjamin Netanyahu will be able to form a government or not, will be held on September the 17th to elect the 120 members of the legislative branch known as the Knesset. So a lot going on here, a lot of reaction to the announcement. The United Nations has blasted it. The UN spokesperson has said that this move would be illegal under international law. The Arab League has condemned it and said that it would be an act of aggression. And of course, Palestinian and regional leaders have sharply also denounced it. Now, here to discuss all of this with us, give us some analysis and context and implications for the entire region, we would like to welcome Curry Peterson-Smith, the Michael Ratner Middle East Fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington, D.C. He researches U.S. empire borders and migration. Curry, welcome.
Good morning. Glad to be here.
Okay. So Benjamin Netanyahu has made this threat before, right prior to the previous election. So do you get a sense that people are taking this seriously, as though you never know if, you know, he gets his way, if he would be able to move on this, Curry?
Yeah, well, I do think that it's very serious. It's the latest, really, in Israel's ongoing efforts to seize control of more and more Palestinian land. And we know that Israel is just escalating their occupation. They're actually and they're making it more visible, and that includes the Palestinian territories, of course. It also includes the Golan Heights, which Netanyahu continues to build a wall around, and of course, the Trump administration supported Israeli sovereignty in the Golan Heights, and so there's been more attention to militarizing that region as well. So, yeah, there's really what's happening is the whole so-called peace process, really, for the past 20 plus years, has just been a cover for Israel to actually strengthen its grip over Palestinian territory. But what we're seeing now are even more brazen efforts to do so. So I do think this is very serious.
And why is it illegal? If he does this, why would it be illegal?
Right. Well, I mean, to settle occupied land, first of all, is illegal. So the whole Israeli operations in the West Bank and in East Jerusalem, it's all illegal, actually, to build these settlements on occupied land. The Israeli wall that they have built across the West Bank is also illegal. So these are violations of international law. And again, it backtracks on the agreements that were supposed to be laid out in Oslo as well. The idea was, of course, ostensibly that this would be moving toward a Palestinian state, but really this whole process has been a way, again, to extend more Israeli control over historic Palestine.
Yeah, well, it certainly wouldn't be the first time that Benjamin Netanyahu has just flouted international law. And one has to wonder if he is encouraged by what is happening in the U.S., where you have a president that certainly doesn't pay close attention to matters of the law here and feels that he could just do what he likes. And then you have in the UK, where you have Boris Johnson, who just dismissed the whole of Parliament for 5 weeks, hoping to be able to get his way. So, you know, these kinds of moves, the way I see it, bound to give even more power to the likes of Benjamin Netanyahu to flout and just ignore international law, because what's going to happen, right? Who, you know, what's going to be the consequence for him or for the country of Israel as a whole?
I think that you're 100% right. I mean, first of all, there's a direct inspiration from the White House to Benjamin Netanyahu and vice versa. If you go to the Benjamin Netanyahu's Twitter page right now, you'll see as his cover photo. It's a photo of him shaking hands with Donald Trump, just to be clear about what that relationship looks like. And so Netanyahu absolutely touts the support that he's getting from the Trump administration when he's making these moves. But I think that you're 100% right to see this in a global context, because what we have is heads of state all around the world very openly flouting international law and flouting just the kind of what's acceptable in public politics. And so you're right to call attention to what Boris Johnson is doing, the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, as we know, has openly been has assassinated journalists, openly continues a war in Yemen that is being condemned all around the world. And as you're right to point out, that the United States is really giving the green light to all of this. And with Israel very specifically, where Trump has recognized Israel's sovereignty, so-called sovereignty over the Golan Heights. Trump has recognized Jerusalem as the capital of Israel and done all kinds of other things to affirm what Israel is doing.
Yeah, and I mean, you mentioned Saudi Arabia. I mean, they increasingly have a pretty cozy relationship, it seems, with Israel. And indeed, even Jordan and other countries, I mean, Palestinians, you know, have felt pretty isolated over the past period as Israel, you know, makes forays into a region that traditionally had supported the Palestinian cause. I mean, you look at Egypt and what's happening there. So that also has likely lent some power to Netanyahu thinking that he could get away with this, as well as a number of other moves against Palestinians that he has made in the recent period. Curry.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. I mean, you have basically U.S.-aligned governments throughout the region. And while there has historically been at least a posturing by certain Arab states to support solidarity, to support the Palestinian cause, in practice, you know, I think that has never been what it really could have been. But over the past 30 years, we've seen these governments in some ways kind of quietly make peace with Israel, of course, receiving more U.S. aid in the process. And at this point, it's really quite open. I mean, of course, it's Israel that is very directly colonizing Palestinian land. But we cannot talk about, for example, the blockade of Gaza without talking about the role that Egypt plays, because Egypt controls the southern border of Gaza. And Saudi Arabia, absolutely, I mean, it's essentially the U.S., Saudi Arabia, and Israel are in an alliance against Iran. And the whole region is being polarized according to this war. A quiet war, and in some ways a very open war, as what's happening in Yemen, as what's happening in Syria. There are all of these proxies whereby you have these the U.S. and its allies on one side are going against Iran. And so in reality, you essentially have an alliance in which Saudi Arabia, Egypt, Jordan, and other states in the region are really working with Israel and with the United States to shape the Middle East in the way that they want to.
Yeah, and meanwhile, it is Washington, it is the U.S. taxpayers that contributes so much. I mean, starting in 2019, the U.S. will basically give the Israeli government $38 billion over the next 10 years. That's about $3.8 billion per year. And that, by the way, is about a little over $10 million per day, right? I mean, when we look at income inequality and homelessness, et cetera, in the United States, you could think of what could happen, what could be done with $10.41 million per day. And then increasingly, there are attempts to criminalize peaceful protests against Israeli policies with the Palestinians. I mean, the attempts to criminalize the boycott, the BDS boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement, for example. And this kind of thing takes place on both sides of the aisle among Republicans and Democrats alike. Curry.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. In fact, you know, folks will remember that there was a huge controversy when Congresswomen Rashida Tlaib and Ilhan Omar wanted to go to Palestine and meet with Palestinian and Israeli politicians and tour parts of the West Bank. And of course, they were denied the right to do so. But just the week prior, AIPAC, the biggest pro-Israel lobby in the U.S., the American-Israeli Public Affairs Committee, hosted the largest bipartisan delegation to Israel ever. I mean, they do these trips regularly of members of Congress to go to Israel to meet with Israeli politicians, to take photo ops with Israeli weapons systems that are paid for by the United States, and they had the largest number of people in Congress doing that ever. So I think that you are totally right to call attention not only to the just what that kind of violence that the U.S. is investing in, what it means for Palestinians, but also what it means for folks here. Because when we talk about things like Medicare for All, or we talk about raising the minimum wage, or investing in education and all the other social needs in this country, there's always this question, well, how are we going to pay for it? And yet, I don't hear anybody in Congress or in the White House asking that question when it comes to supporting Israeli apartheid or Israeli violence in Palestine. There just seems to be endless resources for that.
Yeah, and there's this fear of being dubbed anti-Semitic if you support or if you complain about Israeli policies in relation to the Palestinians. And that's really interesting, because it's almost as though one would be considered, I don't know what, un-American for criticizing any U.S. president, Democrat or Republican. But yet there's, you know, there is this double standard, in a way, quite a different standard, because if you look at what has happened with the Palestinians, I mean, that blockade on Gaza that you mentioned, restricting the flow of goods in and out, nearly 90% of Gaza residents have no access to safe sources of drinking water, 90%, and this is according to the United Nations. 11% of Palestinian families in Gaza have access to safe sources of water. Palestinian children are suffering very high levels of PTSD. Poverty rate has increased from 30 to 50% in the last 11 years. I mean, one could go on and on. Youth unemployment in Gaza now 60%. So people who say, well, you know, one should just keep their mouth shut and not object to any of this are really, you know, missing the point. And one wonders, you know, even when we were fighting apartheid, for example, and I think this is apartheid going on, yeah. The Palestinian people living under apartheid in South Africa, it was much more clear cut in a lot of ways. But there is this kind of emotional, you know, white male, some people say black male, yeah. When you criticize Israel.
Yeah, that's great. Well, you know, we've got to get this right, because you're 1,000% correct to point out that the just egregious human rights violations that Palestinians are suffering right now, to call attention to that has nothing to do with anti-Semitism, or has nothing to do with you know, one's attitude about Jewish people. And I do think it's worth asking, why is it that Israel, why is this question so charged? When you question what other governments do, you're not made to defend it in this way. And so I think there's a lot that's really important to say about anti-Semitism. And really, I think the whole conversation in this country about anti-Semitism is problematic. I mean, among other things, the assumption that all Jewish people agree with Israel.
That's right.
That's anti-Semitic, because it assumes that all Jewish people think in the same way. And so the idea that by criticizing the Israeli government, you're somehow offending all Jewish people, it's worth looking at what your attitude is about Jewish folks, if that's what's happening. But the other thing is, the fact is, there is a rise in anti-Semitism in this country, as there is a rise in Islamophobia, as there is a rise in anti-Semitism migrant racism, particularly toward Latinx and Muslim folks, as there is a rise in anti-Black racism. And unfortunately, I could go on. There's a rise in bigotry. And so Donald Trump is saying that he is he's against anti-Semitism because he's the greatest supporter of Israel. But let's look at the reality. I mean, these far-right anti-Semitic mass shooters who are going into synagogues and shooting them up, who are desecrating Jewish cemeteries, they're inspired by Donald Trump, right?
Yeah.
So it's actually those of us who are in solidarity with Palestinians, who are in solidarity with all oppressed people, who are also in solidarity with Jewish folks experiencing that oppression. I mean, you think about somebody like Ilhan Omar, who is smeared as an anti-Semite, and it's like, well, this person is obviously confronting anti-Black racism and Islamophobia, but also confronting anti-LGBTQ bigotry, standing up for women's rights, standing up for labor rights, et cetera, et cetera. She is consistently for social justice. How does it follow then that she is somehow anti-Semitic? Actually, the more consistent thing is that she's in solidarity with all oppressed people, which organizations like Jewish Voice for Peace have, which supports Ilhan and Rashida, have pointed out.
Yeah, and as we getting close to the end of this discussion here, back to the election then and the significance of it. I mean, even Benny Gantz, who is, you know, was Netanyahu's main challenger in the first election, liberal centrist, the blue and white party, you know, even he actually supports this annexation. He's just opposed to, like, the timing of it, you know, right before the election, because he knows that Netanyahu is using it politically. So tell us about your thoughts and the importance of this move right before this election, this September 17th election in Israel.
Sure. I think the I think the main takeaway is that the Israeli political spectrum has moved so far to the right that there is no, you know, there are no alternatives here that are questioning what's kind of a runaway train of Israeli violence and seizure of territory since they've gotten a green light from the United States. And so Benny Gantz positions, I mean, his party positions itself as more moderate than Netanyahu's Likud party. And yet, in practice, both in the lead up to both this election and the previous one, Gantz has actually criticized Netanyahu from the right. I mean, this time regarding this initiative, and then previously when there was Gantz actually said that Netanyahu didn't go hard enough in confronting Palestinians in Gaza who were resisting. So the whole political spectrum has moved very far to the right. And what Netanyahu is doing is something that'll be very familiar to those of us who live in the United States, which is in the lead up to an election, proving, you know, there's a kind of domestic election agenda here, right? That's trying to shore up right wing votes,
yeah,
by putting forward this initiative. But this also isn't just rhetoric. This actually has consequences in the real world. And that, of course, is very familiar for those of us here when Trump talks about building a wall. You know, this is both about shoring up his electoral base, and it is about, in reality, making things more violent for migrants and other folks in this place.
Yeah, a lot of similarities there. At the same time that the U.S. is giving over $10 million a day to the Israeli government, the State Department froze $65 million in aid for Palestinians. I mean, you just starve people out. Well, we'll see how this election goes. We're going to be continuing to cover this very serious situation there. And you've just been terrific, Curry Peterson-Smith, on this. So we hope to have you back. And thank you so much for joining us.
I'm very grateful to talk to you. Thank you.
Okay. This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. We are going to take a short station break. And coming up, okay, Black Lives Matter and the movement for Black Lives. What's going on in terms of the moves they are making on the electoral politics front with the presidential election coming up? Our Campaigners for Black Lives series continues after our station break. And then port truck drivers in Los Angeles and Utah on strike. What's going on? What's it all about? Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Listening to Sojourner Truth on KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles.
I was slipping into darkness.
All righty. The great Slipping into Darkness. This is By War. This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. If you're a member of Facebook, we're also on Facebook. Just look for Sojourner Truth with Margaret Prescott. And remember to like and friend us and share stuff you find on our Facebook page. And our handle on Twitter and Instagram, at SoTrueRadio. We're also on SoundCloud worldwide. And it's a free app download. And all of our back shows are archived there. And today, we would like to give a shout out to our SoundCloud listeners in Secaucus, New Jersey, in the United States, and internationally. We want to give a shout out to our listeners in Niamey, in Niger. And just amazing there. Very happy to welcome our listeners in Niger and around the world. Well, things are heating up in the presidential election race. There's some new polling information that's out right now, and Elizabeth Warren is giving both Joe Biden and Bernie Sanders a run for their money, so to speak. Joe Biden still very much ahead in the polls, but making a lot of people very nervous because he, just about every time he opens in his mouth, it seems, gaffes happen, and people are really a bit nervous about that. Elizabeth Warren is showing that she's popular among the voting population generally. That's interesting. While Bernie Sanders, very popular among his base, but interestingly enough, not so popular in the general voting population. Also, a warning sign. Trump remains very popular among Republicans, something around 88% or so. And although recent polls are showing that his overall approval rating has now dropped to the, I think it's around 38% or so, and that's down from just a month or so ago. But nevertheless, the majority of voters, the voting population, thinks that Trump is going to win, right? Even though polls are showing that a number of Democratic candidates, including Kamala Harris and others, moving on up to where she is on the poll, can indeed defeat Donald Trump. And another troubling sign among independents, they also think that Donald Trump will win the next election. But one thing that everybody knows is that the vote of people of color, the black vote, is going to be critical to all of this. And the movement for Black Lives, I mean, just last fall, there was an article written about that movement sharpening its focus. And now there is the Electoral Justice Project of the Movement for Black Lives. Before we welcome our guests, let's go to a clip from the Movement for Black Lives on the matter of the elections.
So, black people, the news these days is insane. Just when we wrapped our minds around one harmful decision from our government, there's another right around the corner. Much has been said about the white nationalists with taxpayer-funded salaries at the White House, but there are other big boulders in our road. See, the vision of this country is supposed to include political processes that center our communities and include all of our voices, right? That's really not the case. Structural barriers such as access to voting, redistricting, political gatekeepers and skyrocketing campaign costs. It keeps us from building the power we need to transform our communities and to fight back. In the 2016 election cycle, more than $1 billion was spent. Does that seem like a system everyone can access equally? Black leaders make up just 5% of elected positions. There are more millionaires in Congress than there are women. Our state and local policymakers are passing legislation that's harming our families, and it's criminalizing us for the color of our skin. It's going unchecked because people are intentionally being blocked from voting. Due to a racist criminal justice system, 6 million people have lost their voting rights for having a record. That would be like the entire state of Maryland just falling off the map. Voter ID laws try to say who can vote and who can't. And who can't? People who look like you and me. But imagine what's possible. How about the political home we deserve? With fairly drawn voting maps, with a clear respect for everyone's voices, without barriers. What about a political home that says, I love you, your life is important, and your elected leaders and public policy should reflect that? Just like any other system in this nation, we can disrupt these barriers by seeking justice, electoral justice. Not because any one party or institution or candidate wants us to, but because we deserve it. Because our lives and our Black futures require it. And we're building that home. The Movement for Black Lives has launched the Electoral Justice Project, a collaboration of more than 50 Black organizations that will weave a web of Black civic power in every single corner of our communities. And we need you. So join us at ejp.m4bl.org or text EJP to 91990. In Black love and electoral justice, let's get it.
Black love and electoral justice. Now for our Campaigners for Black Life series, I'd like to welcome our guest, Angela Waters Austin, co-founder of Black Lives Matter Lansing and Black Lives Matter Michigan, as well as the CEO of One Love Global. Angela, welcome.
Thank you so much. Good morning, Margaret. It's a pleasure to have this conversation with you.
Okay, so tell us why the need for the Electoral Justice Project. When people think of, you know, Black Lives Matter members, or even the movement for Black Lives, you think of, well, you're out there protesting the police killings, police brutality. So for many people, this seems like a bit of a shift for the movement for Black Lives. Why the need for this Electoral Justice Project?
Well, just to kind of unpack a little bit of nuance there, so you have Black Lives Matter Global Network, which is one of over 100 members and actually one of the founding table members of the Movement for Black Lives, which is a much bigger ecosystem of Black-led organizing for Black Lives. So what people associate with Black Lives Matter is the protesting, the direct action. And I would just say that the connection, the root of it all, is really about moving policy. We have to be clear that the protest is ultimately about the policy change and about reducing harm to our people and our communities.
Yeah, and I mean, part of the discussion happening now with this election, I mean, we all know, and we certainly have been calling it this out on the show Sojourner Truth, that Donald Trump, white supremacist in chief, not only for the United States, but globally, an inspiration to white nationalists, white supremacists around the world, really, in Europe and Australia and elsewhere. So a lot of the focus right now, I mean, if you look at the Black vote, Black people pretty much right now are supporting Joe Biden, and people are saying, look, we got to get this white supremacist out of there. So in terms of the approach then of Black Lives Matter, the organization, as well as the Movement for Black Lives, to the degree that you can tell us, the thoughts on this, because everybody also knows that if the base of the Democratic Party doesn't turn out, if Black and brown folks don't turn out, if young people don't turn out, then for sure Donald Trump will get another 4 years. Angela.
Well, so the amazing human being that you actually heard in that video is Jessica Byrd, and hands down, without equivocation, she is one of the most brilliant minds in political strategy and the electoral process. And so I'm really grateful that as a co-founder of a Black Lives Matter local chapter, that I was invited to actually be a part of building this electoral justice table, this electoral justice project that is really about how we begin to change the narrative, how we begin to build our collective power, because it is absolutely true. We can move an election towards justice. We can move elections towards reducing harm to our people. And without naming any candidate, because it's really not about us endorsing a candidate or even a party, it is about how electoral politics are really essential to either shaping what our future can look like or continuing to perpetuate a system of white supremacy. So no matter who ultimately is going to be the candidate for the party, then we absolutely want to be clear that our voices, our lives, our issues have to be in the center, not just for the sake of the election at the final hour when they start flooding our communities with voter registration and get out the vote, but really fundamentally to restoring any semblance of democracy in our country. It is actually the lives of Black people and our organizing and our political power that can actually help us save our democracy.
Right. Now, the Movement for Black Lives, they're saying that they will train and resource 10 Black organizers from 10 organizations to serve as political operatives for building Black political power in 2020 and beyond. So that is being put in place. And then they've got a whole list of key issues from racial justice to environmental conditions, criminal justice reform, police brutality, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So how does this play out? I mean, when you talk about building Black political power, give us some examples of what has happened up until now, any initiatives that you have been working on or that you worked on before or are working on now?
Oh, wonderful, Margaret. I think many people will be familiar with Wakanda the Vote from last year, which is really kind of our coming out last year with the Electoral Justice Table and the Electoral Justice Project. So really just turning up the volume and helping us really think about a different Black world, a different Black future, and Wakanda was the perfect setting for us to dream about that and to actually attach that to the voter registration process, to actually get more people out to the polls was a brilliant strategy. And I want to thank Kayla Reed, who along with Rukia Lumumba and Jessica Byrd are the actual table leaders. And so our collective work was building out a fellowship program, our pilot fellowship, the Justice League, Electoral Justice League, was 12 fellows from across the country who were either building political campaigns or issue campaigns, and they are now members of the table. And we're looking into 2020 about how we really concentrate and support fellows in really key places in our country where we know that voter suppression has been an issue, where we know that we have to make sure that we protect folks' right to vote, where we know that we need to mobilize voters just to hold the democracy that we have in those places. So that's really what it looks like over the next year, a collective of fellows working with the table and with our local communities to really build the base. So political power is about education, really understanding how the issues impact our lives so we may see it, feel it, touch it, and be harmed by it daily, but not necessarily understand the policies and the policymakers that are driving it. And so it's making the connection in ways that it's not just about who's on the ballot, but about the decisions that that person makes or how they show up, either representing their community or actually misrepresenting our community. So just even starting with political education and understanding what is it that is actually keeping people up at night and making sure that those are the issues on the table. And that's really the core of how we build political power and a collective political voice.
Right. Well, we're going to be watching this as we are going to be kicking off our presidential election watch. And certainly this is going to be a big part of it. Justin, and wrapping up, though, looking at key issues, one thing I would like to note, I see economic injustice is on there, along with, you know, health care and government corruption, education, common sense gun laws, LGBTQIA and human rights. Black immigration, environmental conditions, voting rights, and suppression. Now, the economic injustice piece, I notice, by the way, and share this with your colleagues, poverty is not specifically mentioned. And we have found, those of us who work on those issues, that when poverty isn't mentioned, it's often not addressed, because economic injustice could mean equal pay, pay levels, the right to organize. I mean, a number of things. And also, too often, the poor, that according to the Poor People's Campaign, are about either the poor or close to poor, 140 million people in these United States, kind of get dropped from the discussion. And I'm sure that that is not the case with this particular initiative, but I just thought I would mention it. Angela Waters Austin, and we want to thank also the Black Lives Matter LA, in particular Dr. Melina Abdullah. We partner with Black Lives Matter LA for our ongoing weekly Campaigners for Black Lives series. So, Angela, we're happy to talk to you, happy to know about this initiative, and y'all are continuing to stir the pot. Thank you so very much for joining us.
Thank you so much, Margaret.
All righty. This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. And wrapping up our show, we're going to take a look at what is happening with the port truck drivers in Los Angeles, California, and in Salt Lake City. They are on strike in both of those cities, protesting their employers' labor practices, including wage theft and crackdowns on union organizing. These are truck drivers who haul heavy loads of boron, a mineral that's crucially part of everyday consumer products like smartphones and flat screen TVs. And these loads of boron are taken to the Long Beach, Los Angeles port, the largest port complex in the United States. So there's a lot at stake for businesses and consumers alike. We'd like to welcome a trucker, a port trucker, Flavio Acosta. Flavio, thank you for joining us.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Okay. So, Flavio, first tell us how long you have been working in this industry and what your experiences have been. Why are you involved in supporting this strike?
I've been working 12 years for Cal College, now NFI. And, well, the reason we are fighting is for the way we've been treated, and we really don't get paid enough for what we do. We're treated as independent contractors, and we have found out that that is a misclassification, since a contractor decides or discusses their pay, and we got no saying on it. We just get told what we get paid, and we don't get to choose the work or anything like that. And I mean, I've found out that that is something that we actually need to fight for. We don't have any benefits.
Wow.
And also, I mean, now that I'm involved in this, we're getting some type of retaliation. Let's say my contract used to be for 3 months, which was normal. Now with NF5, the contracts are made for 6 months. But the people who are involved in this, they are only giving us a contract for 30 days. And see that as a retaliation. Also, our work, it's been given us to other companies. And they give them priority. even though we are working for them, they assure other companies are getting the work before we do. And they give us whatever it's left. If there's nothing left, some of us, of course, stay home.
Yeah, and I mean, this is really quite something. I mean, very, very upsetting to hear. The boron, of course, comes from the Rio Tinto mine. Some of our listeners may be familiar with Rio Tinto. The exact employer is NFI California Carthage Express, or CCX. And, of course, the Teamsters Port Division and the Teamsters Local 848 have expressed full support also for the strike. But Rio Tinto is one of the largest mining companies in the world, and the heart of its business is its open pit boron mine in California. And I mean, the company founders began mining this way back in 1872. This is according to the website. So what you are carrying, I mean, the role that you're playing as a port truck driver and supporting these, hauling these heavy loads of boron, this is the kind of thing people take for granted. I mean, Apple just announced, you know, their new phone, and people have their smartphones, they have their flat screen TVs, etc., and they're totally unaware that they wouldn't have any of this stuff, Flavio, without people like yourself, you know, basically being exploited as independent contractors. And by the way, California just said that Lyft and Uber drivers, that they can no longer be treated like independent contractors. Flavio, just your response to all this.
It's really sad. Like I said, it's not that we are fighting for something just because. California laws have found out that they are actually violating labor rights. And I was in Salt Lake City yesterday. I actually got to speak to Mr. Adam Turner. I think he's the head of Rio Tinto over there in Salt Lake City. Very nice person. He got to listen to us. We gave him a petition about helping us with Carthage and NFI, and he was very, very patient with us, and we are very, very thankful that he got the time and he took the time to listen to us.
Yeah,
let's hope
Something comes from it, because just after the strike began in L.A., an administrative law judge for the National Labor Relations Board ruled that owners and managers of the companies involved are indeed guilty of unfair labor practices, including maintaining a rule that was enforced to prohibit workers from engaging in union discussions, threatening hundreds of employees with plant closure and relocation in the days before the union election, threatening to call the police on an employee who was discussing the company's discriminatory practices with other employees. So quite a lot that you all have to go through. Flavio, people, port truck drivers in Los Angeles as well as Salt Lake City, we hope that our listeners would offer some solidarity in the way that they can. Is there people who want to find out more or who want to support you all? Do you know what they should do?
I mean, for now, I think they could try to contact local A48 if you want to support us or want to find out what's going on.
Okay, local 848. Okay.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Me personally, I have to thank them very much. They don't have to do this for us, and they're doing it. They're supporting us, and I am very, very thankful that they're doing this for us.
Well, I am very thankful, and I'm sure our whole team and our listeners are very, very thankful for the work that you do. It's a dangerous job. It's one that a lot of what we take for granted in our lifestyle would not happen without your efforts, and we certainly you know, stand strong and support for your fight for benefits, for the right to a union and against retaliation, and for living wages for all of you. So we're going to keep track of this fight, Flavio Acosta. Yeah, we're out of time, but thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Yeah, and we'll put up information about where how people can contact the Teamsters Local 848 to offer support. We are out of time. Today's show produced by me. That's Margaret Prescott. I'd like to thank all of our guests and our audio engineer, Mr. T. Teddy Robinson, our assistant producer, Romero Funes. If you'd like a copy of today's show, contact the Pacifica Radio Archives at 1-800-735-0230 or go online to pacificaradioarchives.org. Thank you for listening. This is your host, Margaret Prescott.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. The time is 9:58. Coming up next is Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. We will be playing an older episode since there's no current one for today or yesterday. So look forward to some recapping of some older news with Flashpoints coming up, and then after that will be the Dirt Bag at 11 o'clock. But first, this from KBOO.
KBOO at the Clinton is a monthly film series that benefits your community radio station. This month, we'll host the 10th anniversary of Right to Survive on Thursday, September 12th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater. The Right to Survive 10th Anniversary Celebration will celebrate the Shelter for All movement, participation of Right to Dream 2, and Right to Survive. There will be a retrospective with short films, slideshows, and speakers on 10 years of Right to Survive's work for safety, dignity, health, and well-being for those without shelter. Again, that's the 10th anniversary of Right to Survive on Thursday, September 12th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events. KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of The Boys Who Said No, a documentary film screening on Saturday, September 14th at 7 p.m. at the Multnomah Friends Meeting House in Portland. During the Vietnam War, draft resistors openly refused military service to draw others to oppose the war. The Boys Who Said No is a documentary film featuring interviews with resistors and historians. Individuals featured include folk singer and activist Joan Baez, resistance leader David Harris, Cleveland Sellers of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, whistleblower Daniel Ellsberg, and Muhammad Ali. Again, that's The Boys Who Said No, screening Saturday, September 14th, at 7 p.m. at the Multnomah Friends Meeting House, 4312 Southeast Stark Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.